Astronomy 101, 5th of October.
You're absolutely right, however. Number one convenience, number two, is going to be significantly better to my eyes. I'm going to go for you tonight.
Okay, any questions? Remember to pick up your stuff here before you leave. Okay. Alrighty, so now let's see. Your next lab, I'm trying to remember where we are with those things. Do you have all of the lab answer sheets?
Yeah.
All right, and so, let's see. Number five is a video. All right, so that's the next one. Which one was that? Right, to it, the telescope. All right. Lab five should be a video. There it is. Okay. Now, the way that works is you go online, get the answer sheet for lab five, and it has a title on it. It says Harmony of the Worlds. That's the title of the video. It's in the library. So you go over to the library, take your library card, and you can check it out in that little room there and watch it. And what the idea is to answer the questions that's on that answer sheet. They're usually one-word answers. And just do it in order. Now, the interesting thing I find is you're watching this thing on DVD. There's a pause button and rewind. You can go back. And yet students will hand this in without all the answers because they just felt, oh, I missed that answer. So you can stop the DVD and back it up to get the answer. There's nothing wrong with that. So this is one of two. So that's how the video labs work. Okay. How many of you have to sign up after class? Just give me an idea. Anyone? One, two. Okay. So you just show up there and I'll meet with you. Alrighty. Lights, please. We're moving along now. We're going from our ancient ancestors' ideas, moving through a little bit more modern times compared to those people, maybe around 100 AD in that period. And we're going to move forward from there. So actually, we'll look in general terms of early cosmologies, and we're not going to spend an awful lot on that, and then go back about 600 BC forward to about 150, and there'll be some names that you may have heard of when we discuss these things. And then from there, that'll set the stage as we move into the time we call the Renaissance, where science, as we understand it, started to become a formal endeavor. And I'll speak a little bit about how that worked. So what we want to do then is look at some of the ideas that people had, and we can call this historic advances. Now, ancient people, our ancestors, were pretty sophisticated. They were able to make observations, and from those observations determine periodicities. For example, the time it would take a planet to reappear on the sky, and they can anticipate that. How they did that, the simplest way is just pay attention. Go out and observe and make note of certain things. And then you could do day counts. And those were the simplest ways. A lot of this stuff actually became the motivation for more powerful techniques that relied on mathematical ideas and concepts. And some people have said, when they look at the history of humanity, that probably the most telling motivator of us doing anything mathematical was our observations of the heavens, trying to figure out how that worked up there. And early on, there was sort of the beginnings of a lot of this understanding was based on geometry, a lot of geometric interpretations, because you can draw stuff with geometry. You can draw lines and angles, and you can take figures and divide them up into pieces. And so this was a natural. The application of geometry to the sky was also a natural. If you had a mental picture of what the sky was like, and so the idea of celestial spheres came out, and these various things. So people paid attention, and they were able to make some interesting conclusions. But some of it even went further. And we'll just briefly talk about early cosmologies. You can take entire semesters talking about cosmology, but we'll just look at this from a point of view in terms... Is that him? Was it right there? Because he's not sharing, is he? He's just... Ah, terrible. Early cosmologies. We can go back about 2500 BC with Memphites, if you ever studied ancient... Do they have ancient history in high school or that you have to take? Anyone ever took ancient history? Where'd you take it?
Benson High School.
Oh, okay. So they have... That's cool. That's it. One person in Benson. We always had
current events.
Well, yeah, that's right. Okay, so maybe you heard of some of these things, but the Memphite theology. If we go back around that time, and again, this is Ida Vaia's naive history, you want to delve into it in more detail. But when we look at the Memphites, what they had an idea of trying to explain everything. Cosmology is sort of the study of everything. So they're trying to put everything they observe in some kind of context. And so they spoke of an intelligence that organized... Oh boy, I'm running out of ink again. That organized the, and they called it the divine order of the universe. Let's try this one. That one works. The divine order of the universe. From their perspective, that if you wanted to look at this, there was a creative controlling intelligence which fashioned the phenomena of nature. And this provided order to nature. So this was way back. And why I put it in the timeline I'm going to use is you could see that one set of cultural ideas was probably built on another set of cultural ideas. And some of the things that we think were unique and independent were not. Now, if you go back even further in time and try to make some understanding of what was going on, you get into some very interesting stories that ancient civilizations have come up with, ancient cultures have come up with around this time, and maybe even earlier, 3500, 4000 BC. You go back into Greece, and 6000 years ago, you can see structures that that were there. You know, they're sort of a high civilization to some degree, and they had stories, and these stories were very similar to each other. no matter where you went in certain parts of the world, you would find like, oh, they all got this from the same book, you know, or the same ideas. And then, of course, the questions would be, well, how can that be? You know, you've got all these different viewpoints on how things happened. And, of course, you can use the, what was that Disney movie? We all live under the same big sky. There was a mouse who sang a song in it.
American Tale.
American Tale, that's it. And so, I guess you can use that idea. Well, we all live under the same big sky, so we're going to see things. Now, what we, as you saw with the short video on the Egyptians, you saw, oh, you don't have to sing it. God, you want to stand up and sing it? And we'll,
no,
that was nice. That's a nice touch. So, when you apply this concept, you may not talk about the constellations the same way, but you saw the constellations, and you get the same basic ideas out of this. Well, anyhow, this idea of a controlling creative intelligence was one of these themes that ran through it. And when you start looking at some of the other cultures that weren't directly connected with, say, aligned straight back from a Western civilization perspective, you find some other interesting things. The Egyptians, 1350. For a brief period of time, actually the rule of one pharaoh, the Egyptians spoke of a similar idea, one god, Aton, as you saw in that video, the solar disk. And what was trying to happen here is a formalization of this intelligence as the sun, or something associated with the sun. And this lasted Akhenaten, for one term of his presidency. He was a pharaoh. He died. They went back to the old ways. He was Nefertiti's husband. You may have heard of Nefertiti. They didn't like what he said. Tutankhamun was the next guy along, the kid, the boy king. And they literally wiped out all his name wherever it appeared on any of the carvings. So they didn't really like him too much. But he was trying to establish this order. And as a result, it didn't work out well. And that was it, just for his reign, for a short period of time.
Aton,
Aton, that's the solar disk.
Where were the Memphites located?
Memphis. They used to, in Egypt. So here's this thread, right, and this connection. And then out of here, 1300 BC approximately, you got the Hebrews. And of course, from the stories, they escaped from Egypt. And supposedly with a book based on Aton, Book of Monotheism. So these ideas were embedded at this point, you could say. So they had a monotheistic perspective. And they also recorded in their cosmology, they expanded upon this and came up with six stages of the creation of everything. And again, when you study this in detail, you could see how this thread works. But the six stages... And essentially the six stages dealt with light, creation of light, the sky, dry land and the oceans. And if you're familiar with the Bible, you know about this stuff. That's where it comes from. The sun, moon, stars, sea creatures, birds. And then finally humans. So from this idea, they started expanding it, and again, cosmology is trying to explain everything, so this is their story. But it wasn't unlike, you go back even further, you go to the Babylonians, you go to the Sumerian Hittite ideas, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and such names, and you find, wow, these are pretty similar. And if you were paying attention with that video, the idea why did I just lose the thought there? Boom, gone. That's what happens. So that's why there's retirement. You see, you reach a point, you just, right in the middle, it's gone. But who did I want to talk about there? For Isis. There you go. It doesn't go too far, but as you go on, it does. It leaks right out your ear, and then it's gone. It's on the ground running away. Isis, all over the place, right? His body was carved up. The idea of... the bulrushes, you know, the thing was he was hiding in the bulrushes, right? Whatever, it sounds like the story of Moses, right? So you've got these ties. There's an even weirder thing, though, when you look at some of these cultures. They talk about the sky gods. They talk about these weird battles in some of these things. And it sort of sounds like UFO stuff. So, you know, there's a whole other piece of this that nobody really wants to get involved in, because it would really turn everything upside down if it were the case. However, we need order. We like to order things. And so here comes a nice orderly thing. And most of us are familiar with this if your traditions are from the Judeo-Christian side of things. But if they're not, there are still similarities all over the place. And that's what's important. What's important is not what was said, but why it was said. The thing is, we wanted to force an order on our understanding. We don't like things that don't have a nice closure. So with these cosmologies, what we end up with is more questions than answers. And that we couldn't answer anyway. More questions than answers resulted. So in a sense, we really didn't have any answers. And as a result, you could say, well, so what's the point? Well, that's one reason why some people, would look at this stuff and say, well, you know, why am I asking questions I don't have any hope of answering? Why don't I just stick with stuff that maybe I can figure out? So we're going to jump ahead a little bit to early Greek astronomy. And the time period here will be 600 BC to about 150 AD. BC now is BCE, before Common Era. So that's no religious connotation attached to it. But so you'll see it, BCE, or BC as the before Christ was the old way it was after death. I don't know, ad no dominum, something like that. So we'll start with a name that you probably are familiar with, a guy named Aristotle.
What's the second year?
150 AD. So this is spanning a 750-year period. Then one of the big questions and problems in astronomy when you're dealing with this stuff is there a year zero? You know? Is there a year zero? And if there is, how does that impact when you do your day counts? So what astronomers have done is they've bypassed that problem by picking a point way back in time, this is more modern, and we just said the calendar begins at that point, January 1st, 4,000 something BC. And then we just do counts from that day forward. It's called the Julian day calendar. And it's independent of anything. You just do day counts. Every time the sun comes up, that was one day. So you progress it back. The zero point becomes a problem if you're doing day counts and do you include it? Do you not include it? What's the year zero mean? So it's a headache. But Aristotle, if you know a little bit about him, his main claim to astronomical things was his idea that the Earth was at the center. Earth's center. And if we go a little further back, just before Aristotle, you had the Pythagoreans. I'm just going to sneak it in here, Pythagoras. Now, whether Pythagoras was a real person or just sort of the name they gave to a bunch of people who did this stuff, we don't know. There's a lot of stuff in antiquity that's lost to us, direct stuff. It would be like if the only thing that survives anyone's knowledge of me is the notes you take in my class. So, I guess for that, I won't be well known. They would think, who is this guy? What kind of notes are those? But it's almost like that with a lot of the ancient Greek stuff, because as we'll see, a lot of the ancient knowledge was stored in Alexandria, which was a main port for people moving in and out of, you know, shipping. And the library, one of the ideas was to collect all known knowledge. So before the ship could leave, one of the rules was you had to have your books copied, and then the copies would go into the library. But the library was destroyed, as we'll see, and that sort of killed a lot of stuff. These scrolls that were around that weren't in the library, maybe in somebody's home or something, they usually come up every once in a while. They find some scroll with some new stuff in it. But it was rather interesting. So Pythagoras, these people, the Pythagoreans, these were numerologists. They were into numbers and the significance of numbers. And as a result, the Pythagoreans came up with all sorts of interesting ideas. But one of the ideas that they came up with, this is about 500 BC, was the idea of the central fire. The central fire. Any ideas what that might mean? The sun. All right. Now, for no other reason than they thought it was a good idea, they picked the sun as the center of the universe. And it's a good thing to start with, I guess, because if you figure out, you know, everything's depending upon the sun, you knew day, night, and the crop cycles and seasons. So it was connected to the sun, so it was probably an important thing. Now, for no other reason, there was no a big explanation why the sun would be the center, right? And again, a lot of the information is lost. Aristotle knew of this, of course, and he decided that, let me test it. Now, again, you have to put in the context how the Greeks did stuff during this time, Aristotle and his ilk. Experimentation was a very minor consideration. If you were going to learn about something, your intellect was all you needed. You can think through things. And of course, you would then have nature to guide you. You would talk about motion as being natural or unnatural. Things would move naturally. For example, water would flow from one place to another naturally. If you didn't want that to occur, you had to do something unnatural. You had to physically stop the water from going that way and turn it by using a set of baffles of some kind or pipes or something. And the smoke naturally would rise. If you wanted smoke not to rise, you'd have to do something to interfere with that natural process, thereby doing something unnatural to the object. So this was the mindset. The celestial spheres on which the sky and the planets and the stars would be found were perfect. The sphere was perfect. Therefore, the moon was perfect. These were ideas were there. So Aristotle thought about this and said, well, let's see. If the earth is going around the sun, then I should be able to see, when I look at the stars at different times of the year, because he knew that the patterns would remain pretty much over the course of human lifetime. You're going to see Orion the way Orion looks now and 100 years from now. So that was fixed. But he correctly assumed that if the earth was going around the sun, that if I'm here looking out at the sky and I'm here looking out at the sky, there's going to be a slight shift in the position of the stars. It's called parallax. Well, he was absolutely right. That's exactly what you'll see. Except he didn't see it, so he said, the earth is still. we're the center. Everything is going around us. The reason he did that is he couldn't do an experiment, even if he wanted to, that at the time with the equipment they had, which was none in terms of optical aid, that he could have done the experiment. You need a telescope, at the minimum, a telescope, and to do it really well, a camera. And you can photograph these two positions and measure directly. Or you can use a telescope with a fine measuring device. Now, the irony is that during this time period, the Greeks had fine measuring devices. They had the ability to build some very intricate and complex geared machines. And we just found this out about 100 years ago when a sponge diver was diving, looking for sponges off his ship in the Aegean, and happened to, in about 100 feet of water or so, found this clump of stuff, which when he brought it up, looked at it closely, it was rather weird because it looked like it might have been some mechanism with gears. And it sat around for a while. Nobody paid much attention to it. And ultimately, it was examined more closely. And it has a name now. It's called the Antikythera machine. It was found off the island of Antikythera. And it's in the museum at Athens. I saw it this summer. It's cool. There's just pieces of this corroded stuff, but you can see gears that are in the corroded mass, and they x-rayed it, and they actually built different machinery. So, Antikythera mechanism or machine. You can Google it and see that. So, they had the ability to make some really fine equipment. But there was no motivation to do so. This is almost inconceivable to us today, that you could have a culture that the people who were doing all the thinking, I mean, it was a slave culture in a sense. You had slaves, not in the sense that we think of slaves, but you had whoever you would conquer would be absorbed. You had citizens, and you had people who had no rights as citizens. They would be the slave class. If you were at the upper end, you didn't have to worry about your needs. You know, snap your fingers, essentially somebody take care of what you needed. So there was no motivation to do anything beyond sit down, eat grapes, and think. And that was too bad. But a lot of stuff we could have come up with earlier didn't happen. So Aristotle said, well, I can't see parallax, so the earth isn't moving. We'll put the earth in the center. And there's where it stood for a long time. Aristotle had a huge impact on different ideas. Now, he did have correct views based on astronomy, astronomical observation. And the first one was that the moon is spherical. The sun is much further away than the moon. The sun is farther away than the moon.
You got paid for these things?
Say it again?
You got paid for this?
Well, sort of.
Well, couldn't anyone just make those assumptions, though?
Yeah, they did. The thing is, you had to go back and understand how society was set up. Right? So you rose to power, in a sense, intellectually. See, Aristotle, all right, to put this in the context of the culture, you had two basic ways of looking at life at this time period. You had the Athenian people from Athens, the way Athens was set up to think about things, and you had the Spartans, essentially. Okay, you had the warrior class and you had the intellectual class. And if you were an Athenian, again, this is Idavai's Naive History, so you want to go in and deal with it more detail. But essentially, an Athenian was you were educated. As a child, you were educated in the finer things. You were educated to think and be cooperative and happy and all this. If you were a Spartan kid, here's the deal. If you were an Athenian kid and you stole your neighbor's goat, when you got home, you were in trouble. Okay, you were in big trouble. If you were a Spartan kid and you stole your neighbor's goat, you were in big trouble again. Because if you stole your neighbor's goat and somebody caught you doing it, you were in trouble for getting caught. if you were the Spartan kid, you were in trouble because you did the wrong thing. See, that was basically the society. So now, you've got people like Aristotle. You've got a formal education system set up. So you have the equivalent of professors. These people would be paid by other people to educate their children. If you didn't like what they were doing, you didn't pay them. If it got really bad, you kicked them out. I mean, literally. It's like, if you didn't like me as a professor, it doesn't matter. I still get paid. You get to complain on a sheet or something, right? And that's the end of that. But this time, if you didn't like me as a professor, you'd run me out of town. Right? Essentially, you would just get rid of me. You didn't have to pay me. And then I would starve. So it was different. Did he get paid? Yeah, he did. He was worth it. That's what people thought. So he had these ideas, the correct views.
So then what, did people start forgetting about his presumption that the earth is spherical?
No. People knew about this. See, the idea of a flat earth is sort of a myth in a sense. Because anybody who lives near the ocean knows the earth's not flat. All right? You watch ships come in, you know. They didn't start. You see a little tiny ship, and then the tiny ship gets bigger as it gets closer. It's not how it happens. As the ship comes around the curvature of the earth, you start seeing the top of it. It's still far away, but as it comes around, then you see more of the mast, for example, and then you see the ship, and then it starts to get big when it's in, you know, relatively close to you.
Do
so,
they see the curvature of the earth, or is it just as far as the human eye can see?
No, you know how far you can see? You know how far your horizon is? If I dug a hole, put you up to your eyes, and it's perfectly flat from there to there, you know how far your horizon is? 5 miles. All right? After the earth is curving after that.
2 point something, isn't the earth curved?
Huh?
Don't you see, like, if you can see 2 miles straight, isn't it like 2 miles?
No, 5 miles.
No, the curvature of the earth.
You don't see it. You have to pull yourself up. You have to get up away from it to see it. But I'm just saying, if you're like, you look. As a matter of fact, if you're standing up and looking, your horizon's a little further away. And you need to know this if you're on a ship and you do navigation, because then you can be off a little bit. So the people who live near the oceans, they knew the earth was curved. All right? Where this came from, I don't know, other than superstition in the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, supposedly. And historians don't like to call it the Dark Ages. But that's what you probably learned it as when you studied this. And so it was sort of like, from the European point of view, there wasn't any knowledge, a lot of hysteria with. But that's not true either, so you got to be careful. But some of it sticks, so that was good. Lots of sea monsters also. You fall off the edge. Why would people tell people that? Keep you from traveling. All right, I'm not going on that boat. Why? You're gonna fall off the edge. You know? Okay, I'll stay home. Some people don't listen to those stories. They go anyway, right? Even if it was flat, they'd still go. That's a good thing for us in the long run, I guess. All right. So Aristotle was right there. He was well placed. Who was one of his famous students? Do you know? Yeah. Anybody ever heard of Alexander the Great?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what happened to Aristotle? Well, he died shortly after.
Didn't he go to trial and they...
Kangaroo court, I guess. He died shortly after he was expelled from Athens. For teaching that power and sacrifice to the Greek gods was useless, and thus began the headlong march of humanity toward mixing up religion and other things that would help us figure things out. But even the Athenians had a level of tolerance that you didn't exceed at the time. If you were you played ball, you did everything that was expected of you, everything was fine. Here's Aristotle right up there, and he pissed somebody off. All right, and he was exiled. He was thrown out of the city, and he died. exiled from Athens. So, again, the beginnings where you see historically where you don't rock the boat, right? Because it doesn't matter who you are, if you're rocking the boat is going to cause a bigger problem in the bigger picture of things, where people who are in charge start losing control, you're in trouble. But what was interesting about Aristotle's perspective is that his ideas stuck. Right? Even though he got exiled from Athens, the people who knew about this stuff, he was pretty cool. He got some good ideas. And those ideas stuck, and he became an important figure in terms of this idea, how do you understand nature? And we'll see that throughout time. I mean, Aristotle's views were established and became incorporated with the church. And so there was a point where if you would say anything contrary to Aristotle's views, you were a heretic. You were now comparing what you thought nature was up against what Aristotle thought, which was divine. And as a result, you'd have some problems. We'll see that with somebody named Galileo as a good example. All right, as we move forward in time, a guy named Aristarchus. You haven't heard of him, I'm sure. Actually, he was—he had the store down the street next to Aristotle's house. Almost. I was in Greece this summer. I was in Athens for a little bit, a few days. We were there. It was great. We were there 45 minutes, and poor Linda got her wallet stolen. Her passport. It was like amazing. It was amazing. But then the real Greeks took care of us and made everything better. But they blamed it on the people who came in there. But it was interesting because when you see the old part of Greece, you can imagine these people, you know, walking through these little things, and then the Acropolis up on the hill, and all of this stuff, and you get this sense of, okay, you can understand why people would think this way. And of course, if you're up at the Acropolis and looking over, you can see the ocean from there. And again, the earth's not flat to you. You get this sense when you're watching the ships come in. So very interesting to experience that. So here you got Aristarchus. His claim to fame, relative distance of moon and sun. Now, the term here is relative. They didn't necessarily have the exact numbers, but it's not important. Aristotle knew that distances were such. Aristarchus could do experiments. Again, it was geometric. They would make observations, draw a geometric representation. So they can come up with these ideas that you have relative distances, one being further than the other. So you can actually measure that. And his idea was that the sun was at the center. We went back to Pythagoras. Sun-centered. Now, why did he do that? Why not? You know, Aristotle said it wasn't. Maybe I'll make a name for myself and I'll pick the other one. But Aristarchus didn't catch on, and he wasn't Aristotle. Eratosthenes. You heard this name in your one of your activities. Now, he was actually able to measure the size of the earth, and he did this in a very interesting way, again using geometry. So his claim to fame, we're talking about 200 BC. Now notice, we knew that the sun was further from us than the moon, and we knew how big the earth was, you know, 2,000 years ago. What happened? All right. And what he did was measured the size of the earth and it was a really interesting experiment and of course you know the earth is a sphere when you do this experiment. If the sun is up here and on a particular day the sun's image over your shoulder looking down a water well is seen, and then some miles away there's a shadow cast by an obelisk. If you assume you're on a sphere, which is you could represent as a circle in two dimensions and have so many degrees, 360 is what we use today, and you had a piece of it here because of the angle that the shadow cast, and you knew this angle is some value, okay? And then if you went and you walked this distance between the two locations, then you can relate all these three things and determine using a ratio that S is to the circumference as theta is to 360. Okay? S is to the circumference as theta is to 360. And you can then solve this for the circumference in terms of the units that you measured S in. So if you measured that distance between the two places by steps, like this, and these were calibrated steps, right? So you knew how big your step was. How big is the step? It's one step big. You see, that's all you needed to know. And then when you're done, you could tell how many steps the entire Earth was. So if you could walk around it, you know how many steps it would take you. So if you calibrated this into some unit of length that was used at the time, then you could measure the size of the Earth in that unit of length. So 2,000 years ago, we knew how big the Earth was that we stand on. Right, very interesting, and his method was pretty accurate too. Hipparchus. These are the highlights of some of these people. Hipparchus, his claim to fame, star maps. Let's see, I'll give you a date: 130 BC. His claim to fame, star maps. He discovered precession. Remember the wobble of the earth? Now this is interesting, because in order to discover precession, which took 26,000 years, that wobble, he had to have data of star maps that were really old. All right, you wouldn't see it in a human lifetime. So if he just started out making star maps, then he wouldn't have seen this. So he obviously had reference to really old star maps that would have the sky somehow depicted, so he could compare those old maps to his newer ones and see, oh look, it's shifted. And this is curious. You don't get an awful lot of information on, gee, what were his star maps that he used? You know, where they come from? And when you start digging, the implication is that he did have some old stuff, all right? Because this is something you don't see immediately. Now, you would, unless you had a telescope and you can measure very precisely the small changes that you would have, let's say over a 100-year period, and then you can extrapolate forward. So maybe he did. We named the satellite the Hipparchus, and its job was to, guess what, measure position of stars. So in some of the readings, you might see star positions referred to as collected by the Hipparchus satellite. And that's what it's all about. Stellarium has data from that satellite when it projects and draws the sky for you. Very precise positions based on those stars.
That satellite still working?
No. Hipparchus actually had an observatory of sorts. Now, no telescope. This would be naked eye. And he'd have some measurement devices on the island of Rhodes. What's the island of Rhodes sound like? Rhode Island. And Amerigo Vespucci, that's Italian sailor, when he sailed up the Greek archipelago, he saw the way the islands were, and he looked at the island of Rhodes, and apparently he sailed over New England way up through Narragansett Bay. The story somehow is connected, and the islands, as you go up Narragansett Bay, there are a couple of islands there, and it sort of reminded him of this, and so Rhode Island ultimately got his name from this story, that it was like the island of Rhodes according to Amerigo Vespucci. I have no idea how accurate that story is, but once again I warn you, Ida Vaia is naive history, so you can look it up, but it sounds good. He observed and catalogs. The catalog stars is to make a list, and besides the chart, and just write down certain properties, how bright the star is. Usually that's all that you would get. So he observed and cataloged about 850 stars. Now that's a pretty good number, but the catalog, you have their position relative to other positions, so you would do some observations and measurement. Now this is a pretty good number, because does anyone have any idea throughout the entire year how many stars, different stars, you're able to see with your naked eye?
A lot. When you look up into the sky in a clear night, just in that half hemisphere, you see about 2,000 to 3,000 stars.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot, but that's not all of them, but that's a lot. So out of those 2,000 stars you could see at any one moment, he's got a few of them nicely understood in terms of a catalog. And as we move along, some other things he did. He thought about Aristarchus and putting the sun at the center. Thought it was a good idea. However, when he dealt with it, he figured that's too complex to try to describe how things would move. And again, you're looking at big egos. The Earth is it, we're the center, and it's hard to displace that in a sense. He went ahead and he measured, again using geometric techniques, measured the Earth-Moon distance. So now he's got a number he can attach to this ratio, and he got approximately 29.5 Earth diameters. The value is 30. So he did pretty well 2,000 years ago to actually measure that distance. So again, if the Earth was measured by Aristophanes in feet, in steps, then we knew that you take the number of steps that it took to go around the Earth multiplied by 29.5, and that's the number of steps to the moon. So we knew a lot 2,000 years ago about what was going on over our heads. And then we have Ptolemy. And his claim to fame, planetary motions. A lot was going on historically during this time. We put him at 150 AD. Yeah. Ptolemy. That's not how you say it, so you say Ptolemy. But it's a PT. And there were two Ptolemies. Two Ptolemies. This is planetary motion, Ptolemy. Now, again, the story about Ptolemy. He did some really good work. Whether a lot of his work was his own is in the argument at this point. Some scholars think that Ptolemy was a big plagiarist, that he stole a lot of these ancient ideas and used it as his own work without citing from where he got this. Some people say, no, Ptolemy was a very intelligent person and he took his own data and then came up with his own ideas. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle, where he had original ideas and then borrowed from previous works and through no fault of his own just didn't specify that it was cited from that. It's like if you write a paper and you go through and do your research and come up with, oh, this is good, and you think it's so common knowledge that you don't cite it, and then your professor puts it in Turnitin, and then you're in trouble. You know what Turnitin is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't mean to steal. Well, of course not. You didn't. But the importance of citation. So Ptolemy's ideas of planetary motion. He was a scholar at the Alexandrian Library, as were most of these people, to some degree, or the equivalent of such a place. But he was there in Egypt. Alexandria is in Egypt. There's a lot of Alexandrias, because Alexander the Great, every time he conquered something, he'd name it after himself. So this is like when we say Alexandria here, we're talking about the one in Egypt, okay? Up in the top part of the continent. So he was a scholar at the Alexandrian Library. And apparently he did this work here. He had a 13-volume work, which was essentially called The Mathematical Collection. And what's interesting is most people today, you know, think algebra was invented when they started taking it, and geometry was, but this stuff is old, right? And the which one got ahead of which one, depending upon, was dependent upon the people who were using this stuff, okay? And the actual form that algebra took that you're familiar with was sort of around even this far back in time, but it wasn't as useful as geometry was. So people would do things geometrically. It was a lot easier to explain. And again, it had to do with the perception of how nature works. So the mathematical collection, when you look at some of this stuff, it looks like a geometry book. You know, there was a guy, Euclid, running around, you know, around that, before that time. He came up with his ideas on how the world worked. And so people knew this, and it was well entrenched in these various points of view. And what's interesting, and again, we can use astronomy to show that people don't sit still, and there's a lot of cultural pollination, cross-pollination that occurs. When the Arabs picked this up, they just loved it. I mean, the Arab mathematicians saw this stuff, and they were just all over it. And they actually gave it a special name. They called it Almijeste. And this turned into the, as we call it today, the Almagest. This, the Arab term meant the greatest, literally, and the Almagest is what we call it today. And it ends up in Europe 1,000 years after this time, by way of the Islamic Empire spreading. And so even in our own stupidity sometimes, we know what's important and we take it with us. And this is a perfect example. Ptolemy, this 13-volume work, don't think of this as a volume you think of today. This was like scrolls. So it'd be like 13 scrolls worth of stuff. And some of his stuff was rather interesting, but he put the earth at the center. All right? He stuck with Aristotle, and he had the earth as the center, and he came up with a very complicated scheme to explain this. So his was earth-centered. And the thing is, between Ptolemy's work and what the Arabs did shortly after, again, Aristotle was so powerful, his ideas, that the Arabs used his ideas as well. They carried forward with Ptolemy's ideas. And even when the Arab astronomers around 800, the mathematicians around 800 AD, 900 AD, they were working these problems, and they found a discrepancy in what Ptolemy had come up with that would have indicated immediately that the earth was not at the center. They dismissed it and made a correction for it, right? And again, this again shows you what happens to us when we don't stop and think and then say, wait a minute, why am I listening to that person just because they have a nicer suit on than I do? Right? The thing is, you have to question, and to do science, you must question. It's not a bad thing. It's expected, because there can't be any high priests or priestesses in science. As soon as that happens, then it turns into something other than science, and you're not going to learn as you might have learned otherwise. So Ptolemy's scheme was rather bizarre, but one of the nice things is that he extended the star catalog of Hipparchus to approximately 1,022 stars. And then he came up with that idea of the epicycle. Now, this was his way of coming up with a scheme that would square observation with his theory of how things moved. And again, there was no concern for how nature worked. It was, you had an idea. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to fit my idea on the observation. Instead of letting the observation trickle down and cause you to think of a way that would help you understand it simply, the idea was, I already thought about this. This is how it's going to be. I'll just impose it on nature. So this is a nice example of that. What he did was he came up with, if you put the earth at the center, here's the earth. You could have objects going around the earth, okay? But sometimes, let's say this is Mars. Mars seems to do a really bizarre thing. What Mars seems to do in the course of an observation of Mars over a period of time, as you look at it on the sky and compare it to the background stars, sometimes Mars looks like it's going like this. Then sometimes it looks like it stops, and then it goes back again, and then stops, and then continues the way you normally expect it. It does this little loop. You see it. You measure it. You can measure it on the sky. Now the question is, how do you explain it? Well, Ptolemy did this. He said, no problem. If this is Mars and it's going around, well, obviously it can't be doing that because we won't see it slow down, stop, go backwards, then go forward again. So how do you make it do that? Well, no problem. You just put Mars on another circle. So you make Mars go around its own little thing. Okay? This is called the epicycle. And the big circle is the deferent circle, it's called. So that would be the orbit. And then the epicycle is this little crazy orbit that it's doing. Now the problem, of course, with this is there's what's in the center of the epicycle that the thing orbits. Well, there's nothing. And of course, if you're just thinking about it, you don't need anything. But the thing is, in nature, you have to explain how this can be. And again, we didn't understand how anything can go around anything anyway, so why not go around nothing? It's the natural motion, if you use Aristotle's words, of what an object must do. It must go around this way. Now, is this a good model? Absolutely. You could build a mechanism to actually demonstrate this. And it's accurate. The Antikythera machine may have been one such mechanism, although it came out a lot older than Ptolemy's work. But the thing is, there may have been many versions of the Antikythera machine through time. We just got lucky and found one. It was made out of metals that in the ocean it would corrode, and there was a shipwreck, which is why we found it at all. But there were several of these, apparently, that were made, because there was reference, I guess, in some of the literature.
What was its purpose?
The people that designed models based on it, they counted the teeth of the gears that they could see, and they looked at the ratio of the gears and the various sizes, and then there were little mechanisms that came out through what the case would have been, and they assume it was some sort of an astronomical computer that you could set it up and then determine positions of objects on the sky. Now the thing is that they use the epicycle idea. The older ones, we don't know. This one that we have is old, and it's, you know, in pieces, and it's corroded. It's shut. So we had to use x-rays to get in there, and as the techniques improve, we'll get sharper images. But they were able to build models, and that's what they think it was used for. So we had these mechanized computers to calculate position of astronomical objects. The other thing that's interesting during this period of time is that there were a number of Greek engineers, we'd call them engineers today, that designed various mechanisms to do all sorts of interesting things. But people looked at them as props, you know, like if you went to the theater, you'd have a really cool theater prop. But they designed some interesting things. They had the equivalent would be like holy water in a church, and you'd put a coin in it, and it would dispense a certain amount of this holy water for you before you went into the temple. And so they had all sorts of stuff. You don't see an awful lot about it because it wasn't an emphasis by them. They used to have this thing when they did the plays, the Greek plays, the Deus Ex Machina. Deus ex machina means machine of the gods. And this, the gods in the play, like Zeus would come in on this thing and they would roll it into the scene. And sometimes if they were usually it would be poking fun of the gods, the thing would be shattered or, you know, doing all of this, scattered around. And then they had lightning, thunder. They had mechanisms to produce the flashes of lightning and thunderous sounds. But they didn't have electronic amplifiers. They had to do it with mechanisms that they knew a little bit about how sound worked. So this was not an unusual thing for Ptolemy to come up with this idea and have mechanisms that would replicate it. And it worked. So why would you change it? You see, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And this idea went straight into the Middle Ages and ultimately the Renaissance, when some people started looking at this, like eventually Galileo and Kepler, and said, you can't have something go around nothing. And they came up with a different idea. As we'll see, a guy named Copernicus started that, and away he went. Well, the loss of Greek thought.
That's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just Ptolemy's model. But yeah, I teach you everything. I teach you what's right, I teach you what's wrong. You decide. Had Idavaya told me the epicycle was the way it worked. So, the loss of Greek thought about 500 AD, you know, how do you pinpoint something like this? Well, you don't. You pinpoint it in terms of an individual event. Here you have essentially the fall of the Roman Empire. Now, where do they jump into the picture? Well, Rome and Greece, you know, they were going along sort of parallel for a while. They didn't really steal one from the other as much as you would think. They were going along parallel. The Romans really appreciated the Greeks in terms of the work they did. No, my ancestors didn't want to be like any Greek. No way. Oh, no way. No, what they did was they very nicely complemented each other. You have to understand, if you look at the architecture, you get to see what I'm talking about. Greek architecture, you look at their temples, the buildings that are still around, and they couldn't span great distances. They had to use columns, lots of columns, so they would span relatively short distances. So you never could have a Greek building that had a big open space. The Romans, because of the arch, you could have huge open spaces. And a perfect example, you know, when I was in Greece, I saw the Acropolis up on in Athens. And there's several Acropolises, Acropoli. That was just the name of the center of the town. But the And there was one little one off to the side. It was a temple to Hercules, and it's intact. I mean, it's just the way it looked. You can see what they look like. In Rome, there's a building called the Parthenon. It's 2,000 years old. It's still used. It's a church. It's got a humongous dome and a hole in the dome called the ocula, where the sunlight would come in. And the floor was concave slightly with a drain, so when it rained, it would drain away. And this building's over 2,000 years old, still used today, the Roman building, but they knew about the arch and dome, and they were able to build, they used cement. The Romans had cement. It was forgotten how to use cement for a long time, but they used cement, and they used pumice as part of the aggregate to make it less heavy. So you look at the architecture and you can see the difference immediately between the two. But a guy named Hadrian was a Roman. He really liked the Greeks. And they built all sorts of stuff in Athens that he built. But he was there a lot. So he liked it. So anyhow, you had the form of the fall of the Roman Empire. And again, I devise naive history. I always warn you, because you want to look into this. It's really fascinating. This was tied to a woman named Hypatia.
Well, is that clear?
Say again? No, 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 no. I'm just saying in terms of time. This took a while, okay? You had a bunch of emperors that were a little bizarre, and you know, guys like Nero, and so that, I mean, there was Caligula, yeah. There were some really interesting, probably inbred individuals that weren't related to me, but they were there. But Hypatia is a point in time that you can say, wow, what influence did this have? Now, who was Hypatia? Well, she died at, we think, approximately 415 AD. Right? Now, Hypatia, by all accounts, was a very beautiful woman. And she was extremely intelligent. Two things that didn't go together in this time, okay? She never married. She was probably, you could say, the first female astronomer, first woman astronomer. She was a mathematician. And she was a philosopher.
Whole package.
Say again?
Whole package.
Yeah. Now, she was probably more a philosopher than a mathematician or an astronomer, depending on who's telling the story and what they're trying to make the point across. So, like a Carl Sagan would say, she was the first woman astronomer. Okay, maybe some mathematicians would say, she was the first woman mathematician and philosopher. She was the first woman philosopher. Whoever she was, whatever she was well known, and she had a high position in society. Her father is named Theon. He was a mathematician. They would write about these things. They would write documents on books, like, let's say, Euclidean geometry or something. And they would write theses on these topics. That was the equivalent of cliff notes for students. Okay, they were writing things to help their students understand better. Because guess what? 2,000 years ago, students are the same as students today. You've got this range of kids. They want to do what they're supposed to do, or they're just going to goof off. And so they always want extra help. And when you read about this, that's fascinating, because they had the same complaints. So anyhow, they wrote these things, and she was well known. People would come to seek her out and ask her questions. And she had a couple of students that were one of them was in love with her, and she just put him aside in a very interesting way. I'm not going to tell you, because then you can... You want me to tell you?
Come on.
You want me to tell you?
Yeah. Suspense is killing me.
All right, she said to this guy... All right, she used the equivalent of her sanitary napkin and said, this is all you want, and threw it at him. That's the story. Because you don't want the mind, you want the body. And that put him in his place, but it didn't stop him from working with her. But so she never married. But eventually, at some point, the story gets a little crazy. Either she fell in love with someone. She was a pagan, okay? Now, Christianity was on the rise, and you got this guy named Cyril, who's Saint Cyril, right? He became like one of the popes way back then. And he's connected to this story, because there was also, in the town where they were in Alexandria, in this area, there was a Jewish population, all right? So now you've got this whole mix, and the tensions were high. It's almost like any Middle Eastern city, village today. The same ideas, right? People survived, they got along, but there's this tension. And so the story goes a couple of ways. One, Hypatia fell in love with this guy. The family didn't like it, because he was a Christian, she was an atheist, she was a pagan. That was one story. The other story was, no, Hypatia had no lover, but there was the Jewish group were interested in causing a little bit of trouble with the pagans and the Christians. So supposedly the Jewish group that was there had a dance thing. They were into entertainment. And so they had this big play going on, and then somebody attacks somebody, and they started this little thing. Cyril gets involved and breaks it up, saying, no, we can't live like this. Everybody has to be nice. I devise naive interpretation of history. And Hypatia had nothing to do with it at all. But she was intelligent. She was beautiful. She didn't want to deal with anybody. She just wanted to live her life. Well, one day, on her way to work, a mob attacked her and killed her. But not only killed her, they ripped her skin off with abalone shells. This is a seaport village. So they skinned her, and they took what was left and burned it. History doesn't tell who was responsible. The closest it gets is the little skirmish that happened, and Cyril was somehow involved, because there were a couple of like henchmen that were, you know, everybody has henchmen, right? And so something happened. The church sealed those records. Okay? And now if you try to look at it, I mean, it's lost in antiquity. But it was sealed. Cyril became a saint. He was canonized. All right? But he probably had a bigger hand in this than the history showed. All right? So it's very interesting. There's a good book about Hypatia just came out, and it was done from a scholarly work, so there's a lot of references. There's not an awful lot of material. Again, there's bits and pieces when you look at this old stuff. But she was a turning point in terms of intellect and how things happen. So she sometimes is used as the loss of Greek thought during this time with the fall of the Roman Empire. Yes?
Was she the head librarian at the Alexandria Library?
No. She was a mathematician by virtue of the fact that she wrote a commentary on stuff. Her father, Theon, was a mathematician, and they both worked together on certain things, and he actually referenced her, so that's how we know which Theon was her father. But the dates, it's hard to pin down when she lived, when she died, and a couple of her students. But she was a pivotal point in what happened. I mean, it was just a black eye on the leadership in that town at the time. Okay, any other questions, comments? See you next time. Go over there, I'll meet you. Watch out for abalone shells.
Hey, sir.
Thank you.